First, we're going to talk about the RVIC, Revised Version Improved and Correction, Corrected of the Bible, 2020. Sometimes you can call it RVIC. Others may prefer to call it RVIC. It's the same thing. Now, it's been on the internet for a while. Brother Rick Hill has one called mostholyfaith.com. That's still operational. One can get to it on heraldmag.org, and there are various apps too, and I don't know what they are because I don't have a cell phone or a tablet. But I think we can go now to the next slide. What do we know about the RVIC Bible? It is a complete Bible, both Old and New Testament. About 9 inches by 11 1/4 inches by only 1 inch thick. Weight is about 3 pounds. Actually, it's about 2 3/4 pounds. That's a little bit more than half the weight, say, of a typical companion Bible. The binding, the durable leather, there's gold lettering and gold trim on the cover. And then there's a preface for each testament, and 2 or 3 appendices to explain how to use the footnotes. Appendix 1 is on the manuscripts in each case, and Appendix 2 on translation, and there are other things in Appendix 3 that may be of some interest. I might mention that Appendix 3, in one of them, compares the accuracies of other translations of the Bible, from Wertherham to rather poor ones that in some respects may mimic the King James or poorer. So we can go to the next slide. You'll see a photo. This is what it looks like from the front. Keep in mind that it's just about 1 inch from the top of the cover down to the table below it. And we can go to the next slide now. And this is what it looks like in the Old Testament. There you can see there's quite a bit. There's well into the second chapter of Ruth on that page to the right. And then you see some footnotes down to the bottom. And in the Old Testament, they may be anywhere from half the page to only 2 or 3, as you see on the left page. In the New Testament, it's quite likely you'll see typically 20 footnotes on a page. Now, I could mention that these have now cleared the New York Port Authority, so there should be 990 of them en route to Chicago, and we expect that they will be delivered within this week. So I think we can go to the next slide. The purpose, it's a translation of the King James, or we consider how the King James translation has been improved from the 1611 edition. Actually, 3 years later, they did with a little bit more care create the 1614 edition. And then in the 18th century, there were some further attempts to alter it, to bring the language a little bit more up to date, get rid of archaic words. And in 1885, there was a major revision, the revised version. And then a little later, about 16 years later, the American Standard Version was created in 1901, a slight revision of the revised version, improved. And several of you will note that it uses the word Jehovah consistent of or Yahweh in the Hebrew Old Testament. And so finally, with another 100 years of manuscripts to work with, we've created the revised version, improved and corrected, RVIC, RVIC. Also, there are important words that are more consistently translated, especially theological terms like hell, soul, Gehenna in the New Testament, Most of the American Standard Version footnotes are retained. Incidentally, if you see the abbreviation ARV, that's the American edition of the Revised Version, but it was copyrighted, which made it the American Standard. The RVIC is copyrighted, but you may feel free to use it quite freely. The ancient manuscript discoveries since that of the American Standard Version have enabled a few significant corrections to the Hebrew and the Greek source texts, thanks to the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Old Testament, and hundreds of discoveries of new Greek manuscripts for the New Testament. Now, the appendices are intended to give you a feel as to how to use it, so it won't make anybody an instant expert on everything, but it should keep one from having as to what the manuscripts do and don't suggest. And that's the principal purpose. And just as important, that I am not able to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. Now, in addition, there are footnotes on science and archaeology. They're added as appropriate in places from Genesis 1 on to through the Old Testament. And as I suggested before, there are appendices added on the manuscripts and translation. But most important, interpretation is not by the translator or the reviser. The interpretation in each case is to be left to the reader. So we can go to the next slide now. Now, there's a lot of Greek New Testament information from the manuscripts, because for the Gospels, there's over 1,000 manuscripts for each of the Gospels. I think we can increase that to over 1,500. I think we'll see in a bit one in the Gospel of Luke where there's over 1,600. For the Acts and the Epistles, that's Paul's as well as the general epistles, there's roughly 500 manuscripts for each. In Revelation, it's more like 200, except in the last chapters, very frequently the Revelation manuscripts are broken off in the end. But even in Revelation 20, verse 5, there are 182 manuscripts there. So we're not really terribly deficient. We just like to have some of the earlier, of course. Now, out of about 3,300 total Greek manuscripts, only a few dozen can be assigned a grade A type rating. I can go through this. Of the papyrus manuscripts, commonly they're earlier than the 4th century, so half of them are not. There are numbers assigned, of which perhaps 125 are independent, because sometimes they'll be assigned more than one number to different fragments which turn out to be the same manuscript originally, at least the same scribe. Of the uncial manuscripts or vellum manuscripts from the 4th century on through to about the 10th century, we have 323 numbers, most of which are independent. And of the so-called minuscules or handwritten manuscripts, we have top number is 2936, of which almost 2,900 are independent. So that's why we say there are about 3,300 total manuscripts. Now, I might just toss in an aside here. For the previous religions of the world, they were all on scrolls. But the Christian manuscripts, almost to the last one, are done as codex or codices, the book form, rather than a scroll. Now, we might ask ourselves, why did the Christians do it differently? There would seem to be one very logical reason. You cannot cross-reference scrolls very easily. But if you take your Bible in hand, you can put your fingers in three or four places at once and cross-reference back and forth. So it would appear that is the reason the Christian scrolls are almost always in the codex or book form. Perhaps another little side note that might be of some interest. This got started when I was going to college as an engineer. But in the graduate dormitory, I started my first semester in graduate school, and I came into the dining room and sat down across the table from a fellow I didn't recognize and introduced myself. He says, "I'm Peter Parsons. I'm from Oxford, England." And I say, "Fine, what are you studying here?" And he says, "Papyrology." And I says, "What? Papyrology, you know, the study of papyrus manuscripts and papyri." And I said, "That's interesting." And thought, "Does the university have any Bible papyri?" He looks at me kind of funny and he says, "Well, I guess you've come to the right place. It's got the largest collection in the Western Hemisphere and fourth or fifth largest in the whole world." And I'm thinking, and I'm here? Before the semester was up, I had access not only to the manuscripts that were there, but also to the professor of papyrology. If you can imagine there was such a thing, there was Herbert Kain Newty, well known, and also to the published texts from around the world. So 1959 is when I first started working on the RVIC without having any notion of it at the time. I'll toss in an extra thing. At one point he said, "Well, you know, the Greek New Testament is the second best attested work of ancient history." And I thought that was good. And then, of course, it led to the obvious next question. "And what is the best attested?" And with a twinkle, he says, "Well, the Hebrew Old Testament, of course." So now, of these roughly 125 papyrus manuscripts, there are that are older than Constantine's time. Perhaps a little bit more, but about 60 are older than Constantine's empire. So they would not have been influenced by the Trinitarian controversies. Most have been published only since 1901. I think the first papyrus was in the Oxyrhynchus Papyri of 1898, and then the rest have followed other. There were a few written even as early as the second century. Some of these have proved to be a concern for those who had believed that the New Testament wasn't written until much later. In fact, the School of Higher Criticism had convinced itself that the writings of John could not possibly have been written earlier than about the late 3rd century. And then came the Chester Beatty Papyri, which are in Dublin, Ireland, but much of the epistles of Paul from around 200 AD are in Ann Arbor. I need to see them there and hold them in my hot little hand. Well, it turns out that there's the one we call P45, Chester Beatty Papyrus number 1, has pieces of all four Gospels and Acts from the early 3rd century. Now, if you'll recall, maybe half a century ago, scholars discovered a third manuscript of the Gospel according to Judas. Third one. Compare that with 1,500 manuscripts of each of the four Gospels. And here is an early 3rd century witness to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. John was supposedly not written until the late 3rd century. And that's topped by John Ryland's library in Manchester, England, with papyrus number 457 from somewhere around 125 AD. roughly a century and a half before John would have been written, according to the school of higher criticism. Well, I shouldn't get carried off too far on that. We can go to the next slide. I'm using footnotes about manuscripts. Each manuscript is assigned a letter or a number. As for example, these are all very good manuscripts. There's a P, often given in Gothic type lettering, old German type lettering, with a superscript number on it. And then, well, I'll mention there's A and B and C and D and so forth. But after they finished with the English alphabet, they started with the Greek alphabet until they ran out of those letters. And then the Sinaitic manuscript was discovered. So they gave it a Hebrew letter, Aleph. B is for the Vatican 1209. 048 is another excellent early unsealed manuscript. But once in a while, you'll have a 10th century or a little later manuscript written in handwritten minuscule form. Number 1739 is well worth remembering throughout the epistles. So, but to help the reader quickly, the better the quality, the larger typeface. If we talk about the typeface being size 12 for the best manuscripts, then it'll be size 11 for grade B, size 10 for grade C, and so forth. So yes, among the best manuscripts, B75, Aleph, the Sinaitic, or B, the Vatican 1209, they're good everywhere they exist. And not quite so good as C, or number 1175, but still pretty good, grade B. And then you have those that are not quite so good. Letter P, or 2344, is still a smaller typeface. Now, the best manuscripts trump the vast majority of total manuscripts. So if you have 90% of them with one reading, and 8 to 10% of them have a different reading, but they 8 to 10% includes almost all of the best, then we take the reading of the 8 to 10%. Because running the presses longer and faster does nothing to improve the accuracy of the book that you're publishing. Now, P75 is in the Bodmer Library in Cologne near Geneva, Switzerland. That was published about the time I was in school. It's Papyrus Bodmer 14 for the book of Luke and 15 for the book of John. Early 3rd century, and it's top quality in Luke and John. Then you have the Vatican 1209 from the mid 4th century. Top quality manuscript, not perfect either, but very much like P75. And the Sinaitic manuscript, again, about the same time, mid-4th century, top quality, very much like the Vatican 1209. The Alexandrian is a mixed bag. It's early 5th century. It's poor in the Gospels, but elsewhere, it's top quality, all the way from Acts to Revelation. And then there's the Ephraemi. Why is it called Ephraemi? Well, that's because they had a good Bible text there, and they wanted it for the writings of St. Ephraim, so they scratched the Bible text off and wrote over it the writings of St. Ephraim. But we can still read under it pretty well. It's better than the Alexandrian in the Gospels, but not rated with Vatican and Sinaitic manuscripts. Elsewhere, it's top quality. In the book of Revelation, it's our very best manuscript, even if not perfect. In the RVIC, Old Testament Appendix 1 for the Dead Sea Scrolls and other things, and the New Testament Appendix 1 for the Greek New Testament manuscripts and early translations or versions, as we call them. I might mention that among others, we have the P P46, that's in the John Rylands Library and Ann Arbor. And that's from around 200 AD. And it's a good manuscript, not quite as good as P75. P66, similarly, not quite as good as P75, but that's of the Gospel of John from around 200 AD. Very much earlier than the Vatican and Sinaitic by perhaps a century and a half. So I think we can go on now to the next slide, and we'll take a look at what we can find on Luke 23:34. And this is what you'll find in the RVIC itself. It will say, for Luke 23:34, and parting his garments among them, they cast lots, but nothing more. In front of it, 381. So you look down into the footnote, and it says 381. So you've got P75, Vatican 1209. Whoops, Aleph with a little A. That means not the original scribe, but the first corrector. He may have been the scribe himself. You can tell by the style of his writing. And it's also going to be mid-4th century. 070, which is another grade A manuscript. Grade B, you've got 579 and 1241. The Coptic Sahidic is an Egyptian translation from the south of Egypt. It's full-size type, so it's grade A. Then you have the Syriac Sinaitic manuscript, a little bit smaller. It's good grade B. You have a total of 15 Greek New Testament manuscripts with this reading. Compare that with the Sinaitic. You've got an asterisk there. That means the original scribe, grade A. Then you have manuscript L, Regius, from the 6th century, I think it is. And it's good grade B manuscript. And 33, a little lower, grade C still. And you've got a majority of lesser Greek manuscripts, along with the Syriac little manuscript C there. It's the Curitanian manuscript, because Curitan discovered it. It's good quality. It's good grade B. The Vulgate is, and the ancient Latin superscript E, it means it's one that came from North Africa somewhere. And you have pretty good translations, early versions, Georgian and Armenian, good grade B, and they add this sentence, and Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. About 1,630 manuscripts. Well, that's order of magnitude more than 15. But it's just wanting in real quality. Just one manuscript, was four, but it's sort of averaged out by the first corrector as reading the other way, crossing it out. So your conclusion from this is the three best manuscripts omit the extra words. The Sinaitic manuscript is split between the scribe and the first collector. So it's a clear choice between quality and quantity. Almost always you pick the quality and omit the words. And then after you've decided that's what the manuscripts say, we could look at Matthew 23:35 and find that in Matthew 27:25 also, it doesn't seem that God did forgive them. He made Israel pay the penalty, or should Judea pay the penalty at that time. So we decided logically that those words should be omitted, but also that it seems to be confirmed by manuscripts which say that God did not forgive them when they said, His blood be upon us and upon our children. That was a poor decision on their part, wasn't it? We can go now to the next slide, John 1:18. This is a little bit shocking when you first read it. No man hath seen God at any time, and only begotten God, who is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. We're accustomed to seeing the only begotten Son. So what's the choice here? The choice is between the different kinds of manuscripts. That without the additional words, or without the change to an only begotten Son, we have B66 around 200 AD, the Vatican, the Sinaitic, Regius, Ephraemi. On the other hand, there's a little different reading in B75, grade A, and 33, grade C here, and the Coptic Boherit, that is northern Egypt, the Delta, and they read the only begotten God. They add the definite article. Well, they're certainly altered from the first reading, an only begotten God. On the other hand, you have a good manuscript, 892, good grade B manuscript at least, and C, another good grade B manuscript, and most lesser Greek manuscripts. Again, the Afro-Latin, that's IT with superscript E, the Vulgate, the Syriac-Kyrenian manuscript, the Armenian, they read the only begotten Son. So as we analyze it, or as you can see it when you're looking at the Arabic, all four of the oldest and best men from near 200 AD, those two papyri, they agree. And so also the Coptic Boherit. Well, it may be a little tough to swallow, but still, that's the evidence. When we recognize what the apostle wrote, it then behooves us to adjust our understanding to it. What John wrote is not pleasing to Arians, but it's yet more difficult for our Christadelphian friends who don't think Jesus had any pre-human existence and do not think he has divine nature now. And, of course, it's horrible for Trinitarians as well. After all, with the reading, no man has seen God at any time, an only begotten God, well, to the Arian, that's the strongest evidence that John 1:1 is talking about two separate and distinct gods. So I think now we can go on to the next slide, Acts 20:28. The better manuscripts read, the Church of God, which he has purchased with the blood of his own. In this case, it would be his own son. And the footnote reads, so P74, good papyrus manuscript, followed by the Vatican and the Sinaitic, Alexandrian, and the Ephraemi, almost as good here in Acts. Then 1175, that's a good one. 33, yes, in Acts. 1739, these are good grade B manuscripts in Acts. On the other hand, 2344 and the majority of lesser Greek manuscripts read his own blood. Now, regarding the translation of to idio, compare 1 Timothy 5:8. If any man provide not for his own, well, for his own kin is what we insert there. And so it's just like here with the blood of his own, that would be his own son. His own kin could be, but his own son seems pretty obvious. It's another clear case of quality versus quantity. The quality is overwhelming. Those four manuscripts there, P74, Vatican, Sinaitic, Alexandrian, are good grade A manuscripts. And these other four are good grade Bs. But 2344, you can see that smaller typeface still. It's only grade C in Acts, and that's the best evidence they have for it. So a vast majority of later manuscripts cannot trump the oldest and best. Some translations still say his own blood. But that simply is a bad translation, usually with a Trinitarian bias. We can go on now to the next one, 1 Corinthians 15:51 and 2, which is kind of a shocker initially. We're not accustomed to the word not being in this location, but the proper manuscript evidence is we shall all fall asleep, but we shall not all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, in the last trump. In the footnote, we see that's the reading of the Sinaitic, the Ephraimic, the Alexandrian first scribe, the 1739. 33 is pretty good here. So is 0243. And the Armenian, which is a good grade B version. Evidence for a different reading, the one that is in the King James. That's the Vatican 1209 and manuscript 81, which in Paul's epistles is a good, probably grade A manuscript, and 575 lesser Greek manuscripts and the Coptic. They read, you're more familiar with it, we shall not all fall asleep, but we shall all be changed. Now, our oldest manuscript, around 200 AD, P46, Chester Beatty number 2, almost alone reads, we shall not all fall asleep, but neither shall we all be changed. The Beza, let's see, this would be the Cambridge manuscript. The original scribe, along with the Vulgate, almost alone read, we shall all be resurrected, but we shall not all be changed. That one clearly has been altered from their manuscript that the way that's written by the Sinaitic, Ephraimic, Alexandrian, and so forth, as it is up at the top. It's been altered from that rather than from the King James type reading. And then there's seven lesser Greek manuscripts say we shall all fall asleep, but we shall all be changed. And that just has no good enough evidence to even consider. So among the grade A manuscripts, six is better than two. The Armenian, Coptic, and Latin Vulgate are all about equal. The scribe reading is evidently altered from that of those as we mentioned. And not only. Hello, is somebody speaking up? Now, as we interpret, the original text is consistent with soul sleep, but not with immortality of the soul, which likely accounts for the alteration. And note, too, instead of at the last trump, literally in the last trump means during the last trump, not at, not as though the last trump was an instant of time, but rather the last trump is extended over a period of time. And I think we can go now to the next. That would be 1 Peter 3:18. Now, here's one where I have to disagree with the Greek New Testament fourth edition of the United Bible Societies, and also of the Nestle Allen 27th and 8th editions. In 1 Peter 3:18, Christ also for us died for sins once. Is it died for sins or is it suffered for sins? That's the difference. As it's given here, that's essentially the reading of the Sinaitic scribe. It's a very minor difference. 1739 and 1852, all grade A manuscripts there. Grade B, 1881, 1243, 2344, 33, 322, and grade A, Coptic Boharic, or Northern Egypt. On the other hand, P72 and the Alexandrian and C, which are grade A, and 1241, which is good grade B, and the Armenian read, for you died for sins once, instead of for us. Well, that's evidently altered from the first reading. But now we have the one in the King James from the Vatican 1209 and a majority of lesser Greek manuscripts. They read suffered for sins once. That's much the preference of the Calvinists, to be sure. You can compare that with chapter 2:21. The Ephraimi, at least the original scribe appears to have been, along with the Coptic Sahidic, that's grade A again, and the Vulgate, they read, died for our sins once. That's a difference in the preposition. Um, 81 reads, for us suffered for sins once, which would be corrupted from the Vatican 1209 reading. So we read it. Seven great A manuscripts read died, as well as the best ancient versions, against only one great A manuscript that reads suffered. The Greek New Testament fourth edition scholars think that because Peter nowhere else uses the word died, that suffered must be in the original. But only in this one passage is it connected to the atonement for sin. So died is evidently the original. Now, the Greek New Testament first edition reads died, yet the fourth edition changed it to suffered. There may be some theological bias here. Calvinists would much prefer suffered. They think that suffered is the source of atonement, not his death. Those who are more of the Lutheran persuasion will say, no, Christ died once for all, that he tasted of death for every man, and that's death. But I think we can go on now to Revelation 20, verse 5. This is the first resurrection. That's the entire verse 5. You look down in the footnote, footnote number 5. That's the reading of the Sinaitic 2053 and 2062, which are Ecumenius manuscripts of grade A quality. Grade B is 94 in Revelation. And here you've got an M with a K on it. A little lower, you'll see M with an A on it. There are two kinds of majority texts for Revelation. K is for the Koine, which came from around the 4th century for its origin, and A, which came closer to the 6th or 7th century for its origin. So with the reading omitting the rest of the dead live not until 1,000 years were finished, about 70 manuscripts total. I'm not counting a couple of them that appear to have been copied from 2062. The Syriac also. It was never in the Syriac or Aramaic. You can see that in the translation. But on the other hand, the Alexandrian 1611, grade A manuscripts, manuscripts 1678 and 1006, 2050, good grade B, grade C, or worse, yeah, really poorer in each case. The Andreas text manuscripts read, and the rest, not but the rest, but and the rest. So that, with the Vulgate and the Coptic, add the rest of the dead live not until 1,000 years were finished. And the Ethiopic, about 13 unworthy Greek manuscripts read, lived not again. So again, just has no foundation. So initially it appears evidence for inserting a sentence is evidently evenly divided. The age of the texts favors omission, though. There's five different ways we can look at earlier and later versions. And in each case, it's the later edition that adds the sentence. But in the earliest form, without any conjunction at the beginning and without the word again, there are only three manuscripts that have it in that form, versus 70 that omit it entirely. So in more detail, you can look at the RVIC Appendix 1 of the New Testament, and Example 3 gives it to you in detail. Also in Table 4 in detail. So I think we can go on now. Well, I might mention one other thing before I do. We have almost, well, no, I don't think we have time really to tell about 1 John 5, 7, and 8. But that was one where Erasmus was tricked into adding these three, there are three that bear witness in heaven, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and these three are one. And in desperation, when they pressed him for his omission of it, He said, you show me one Greek manuscript that's got it, and I'll put it in my next edition. Now, the editors from Alcala, Spain, brought him a manuscript, number 61, when the ink was hardly dry. And as Caspar René Gregory, Tischendorf's successor, put it, it's a pity he made that commitment, because it's taken 400 years to get those words back out again. We can go on now to the next slide. The translation is improved. We try in the RVIC to take the word, the Hebrew word nefesh, and as consistently as we can translate it soul. And that's there it is in three times in Genesis 1, chapter 2, verse 7, where it applies to Adam. And then we see it in Numbers 9, 6, and 7, it applies to dead souls. And in 31:28, it applies to both humans and animals. Now, the Hebrew word Yahweh is consistently translated Jehovah, and the changes made by the Sopharim from Yahweh to the Lord or God have been reversed. Most of them are listed in the Companion Bible. So in the RVIC, the name appears over 7,000 times instead of just a bit shy of it. In Psalm 45:6, we see the parallelism of two lines. It causes the ASV margin to be switched with the ASV text. Thy throne, in order to be parallel now with the second part, let's see. The second part is a scepter of equity is the scepter of thy kingdom. So the scepter is repeated in the following line, with thy throne is the throne of God forever and ever, rather than saying thy throne is God forever and ever. And we have that also then in Hebrews 1, verse 8. Either would be a legitimate translation. So you decide what makes the most sense. And we can go on to the next slide. What about that word Godhead? It was a perfectly good word at the time that the King James was translated. It was used in three scriptures, showing them there. It was an appropriate word in 1611 when English was closer to German. Example, you have the word Cronkite, literally meaning sickness. Now, somebody sneezes, you say Gesundheit. Literally, it means healthness. Well, we just plain say health because we don't use the word healthness. Similarly, at that time, though, Gottheit, anglicized to Godhead, means godness. So we don't use that word, so we change it to the divine nature or the nature of God. There are three different Greek words from which it was translated, Godhead. I think we can go on to the next one about two memorial scriptures. And if I'm out of time, just let me know. Sometimes the Greek or the Hebrew is more ambiguous or more specific than you can English. And so we have in 1 Corinthians 10:17, seeing that we, the many, are one bread, one body, or it could be translated just as accurately, seeing that there is one bread, we who are many are one body. Well, I think the latter is the better thought, because remember, it says, Jesus said, this do in remembrance of me, not in remembrance of us. But because the first reading requires no italicized words, that goes into the text, and what I think is the better one goes into the footnote. And you, the reader, have to make the decision as to which makes more sense. And this is my body, which is broken for you. There's only one great manuscript from the 11th century that adds the word broken, while seven better and older manuscripts omit it. So the RVIC won't even mention that one. in the footnotes. Similarly, the word given is inserted, but it's in Luke 22:19. We can go now to the last slide. Just reviewing that the RVIC principles or RVIC fundamentals, we try to retain the wording of the King James Revised Version and American Standard Version, except where accuracy requires a correction. And I admit, too, instead of yea, yea, we say yes, yes. Nay, nay, no, no. We show the manuscript evidence where there's a change in the Hebrew or the Greek, the earlier Greek or Hebrew. We suggest physics implications in Genesis 1, what the modern nations of Genesis 10 would correspond to, and archaeological connections of several events from Genesis on through the historical books, and sometimes even after that. There are five appendices that discuss manuscripts, translations, and even the second millennium B.C. chronology, the first millennium B.C. chronology, and even to the age of the universe and the earth. Now, it's fundamental that the translation must be done without regard to theology or expectations of prophecy. Italics are used to show supplied words not explicitly used in the Hebrew or Greek. If you think you read better without the italicized words, you omit them. The interpretation is to be left to the reader, including alternative wordings in the footnotes. An exception is offered only in one place, that's in Daniel, where the histories are not very really not taught in the schools. And those are the fundamental principles by which the RVIC is translated. We hope this has been a help and a blessing. The Lord bless you, each and every one.